Okay, this is continuing with Robert Coates on 15th August 1981. Yeah, you're coming through all right, but a little bit louder would make it even easier, please. So you were working closely with AFA in a statistical manner, in the sense that not simultaneous observations, but getting the general nature of the spicules as could be seen from photographs versus your brightness distribution at 4.3 millimeters.
That's right.
Right. Let me ask about the general atmosphere in the radio astronomy branch at NRL at that time. Were you pretty much entirely on your own as to the direction that your research could go, or was it much more of a directed kind of research as far as somebody telling you that this is worthwhile to do or you must stop doing this kind of thing?
That research was pretty open. Hagen was in charge of the branch, and actually Hagen was my NRL thesis advisor.
Right.
And I had talked with Hagen quite a bit and defining the research that I would conduct. But Hagen left things pretty open. Each one of the individual people doing research was very much on his own. And it was very much like a university
act. Yeah, well, that is a bit surprising in the naval context, although, of course, I know NRL from working there in the late 60s, but one might expect that it would be more directed mission-oriented research, and if you could do some astronomy at the same time, fine, but it sounds like it was rather different than that.
Well, Hagen was successful in setting up a pure research program.
Mm-hmm.
Switched over from doing a direct application radar, radar for submarines,
right,
things like that, to a pure research.
Yeah.
We had no requirements to build anything for the fleet or anything.
Okay. These observations you did were all on small antennas. You never got involved with the 50-foot or the 84-foot at Maryland Point. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah, because you were only interested in these short wavelengths, I guess, basically.
Some of the that's correct, but SC did equip that 50-foot antenna for 9 millimeters.
I see.
And we did conduct some scans of the sun at 9 millimeters. I did analyze that data as supplementary data to the eclipse data.
Mm-hmm.
But at 4 millimeters, no, the antenna was no good.
Right. Well, I'm surprised even that you could get anything out of it at 9 millimeters, but you did get some useful information.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. It wasn't that bad. It was pretty good.
Hmm. Interesting.
As a matter of fact, the biggest problem we had was measuring the antenna pattern of that antenna, because you had to be 20 miles away to
get to the far field.
Get into the far field.
Right.
And so I arranged to get a Navy airship out of Lakers, New Jersey.
I see.
We put a 9 millimeter transmitter on that.
Uh huh.
And the airship would take off from Lakers, get up about 2,000 feet, and then aim it towards Washington,
right,
and then proceed at a very slow ground speed.
Yeah.
With that, it was like it was standing still, and the SC at the other end was visibly measuring the antenna pattern.
Yeah. That 9 millimeters, no work was ever attempted at anything other than the sun at that time, was there? To try to detect an H2 region or CASA or anything like that? Do you remember?
I believe that Hagen and Steve did try to pick up radio stars, but with no success.
Yeah. Well, we can easily see now why they didn't have any success, but
yeah. They
did try, I see. What about solar activity? So far you've been talking pretty much about the quiet sun. Were you interested at all in that?
Well, you see, in 1954, that was the solar minimum.
Right.
And fact, for looking at the quiet sun, it was perfect. The 54 eclipse, no sunspot, no solar activity, and there hadn't been any for several weeks before or after. So it was the perfect time to do the quiet sun.
Right.
As solar activity began to build up and they formed the International Geophysical Year.
Right.
Then the effort was focused more towards studying the activity, the solar activity. And for the IGY, I set up an optical telescope for observing the activity of the sun. It was an H-alpha filter and continuously recording camera.
Yes.
And then Haddock and Mayer and McCullough set up the 10-centimeter system and a 3-centimeter system that tracked the sun all day long.
Right.
And Gibson did some 8-millimeter monitoring of the sun, tracking the sun. And then when I got the 4-millimeter system working, I likewise tracked the sun. So there was coverage from 10 centimeters all the way through 4 millimeters, supported by the H-alpha optical pictures of the sun.
And you did this solid for a year and a half? Or?
Yes.
I see.
And that led to the first reporting of any measurable solar activity at 4 millimeters.
Right.
Not very big, but...
Well, I see one article you had in Nature in 58 on a slight enhancement at 4 millimeters, mm-hmm. and a couple other things in which you did, working with other people, you correlated H-alpha and so forth, as you were saying. Do you think that this solar activity studies, what do you think is the main scientific results that came out of that?
The main result was to extend the spectrum of the solar burst so that the theoretical physicists would be able to better determine the structure of the medium generated.
Some more concern.
I didn't pursue that any further because at the end of the IGY, we had these measurements, and I transferred over to NASA.
So in 59?
Yes.
Already, I see.
Yes, it was in 1959 I transferred to NASA, and no one at NRL picked up that work after I left.
Right. Right. But now, you did do some lunar observations also.
Well, at the time that we were doing the solar work, monitoring the sun, I was also interested in the structure of the lunar surface.
Right.
And so, in the daytime, I was making scans on the sun to determine the brightness distribution. And at nighttime, I was scanning the moon. And the variation in the brightness of the moon as a function of phase of the moon.
Right.
Now, Gibson was doing that work at 9 millimeters, and I was doing that work at 4 millimeters.
Right. And so you published results together?
Right.
Well, actually, I don't see you together here with Gibson. I see a couple articles by you on both 4 and 8 millimeters. In APJ 61 was the last one, and then in the IRE publications.
Well, aren't some of those joint with Gibson?
No. There's some joint...
I'm trying to remember. It might have been... Gibson might have published the papers.
Yeah, I think there must have been, because it's a pretty complete bibliography. You have joint ones with McCullough and Santini and so forth on activity of
the sun.
But the lunar stuff is just yourself.
Well, the lunar stuff, again, that was interrupted because I had just gotten the map, the data analyzed to generate the map. In fact, that lunar work was really published after I was at NASA. And I think showed up when I was at NASA.
I see.
And so it was not carried on to the next paper, which would have been the structure of the crust.
Right. And I guess that languished also after you left. And they did radar, of course, but the passive work didn't get carried on, did it?
That's right.
Yeah. Well, in closing, I'd like to ask a couple of general questions. First of all, what do you see as the strength behind the success of NRL and radio astronomy through the 1950s?
I think there were people that really put that program together for the prime movement. That was John Hagen primarily. Very close behind him, Fred Haddock.
Right.
And they really had a very keen interest in the astronomy science, and they were outstanding engineers to press the technology. So they had both the instruments and the science that really made that program produce. And I think once the program producing NRL was recognized internationally as one of the leading organizations. That certainly distinguishes most of the other people in the branch.
Right,
continue that on.
And so what you're saying is essentially the atmosphere and the created by them, and once it got going, then it was self-perpetuating. But also it would seem to me that the tremendous facilities that one has at a place like NRL, in terms of shops and budget, really helps also. Would you agree with that, sir?
Well, that was true. The shops and the system we did, because a lot of that work was done, like all the 10-foot antennas, the millimeter waves, that was all done in our shop.
Right.
And we got some terrific products from those shops. Shop people really were enthusiastic because these shops were quite a challenge for them.
Yeah, yeah.
That's quite true. Without shops like that, we would be tough.
And what about, from what I've seen, it seems like you were in a pretty good budgetary situation. I mean, no one ever has enough money, but in essence, you had quite a bit of funds to do pretty much whatever you wanted within reason. Would you agree with that? Or?
Well, I think the people there were very heavily do-it-yourselfers. That I think that most of that work was done on a very minimal budget.
Yes, okay.
I know, like in my work, the 4-millimeter work, I built everything myself.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what took me longer. Time, but there were no commercially available microwave components. There were no wave guides, no antennas. There was nothing there. So I set up a shop, the electroform wave guide, and to manufacture all the components that I need.
Yeah.
And we didn't get charged directly for those shop works. So in essence, I ran on a $0 budget.
Yeah.
I had to buy a few things like IF strips and things like that, but I think I used to operate on about $10,000 a year.
Yeah, yeah. But of course, you didn't get charged for transport of all the stuff to the eclipses and all that kind of thing either.
No, that's right.
Or setting up that balloon with the transmitter on it. And,
right. And that, I mean, Hagen was able to arrange all of that, and you're quite right. If you wanted to do something, well, there seemed to be a way to do it.
Yeah, yeah.
We were able to get Navy support to do it. We had a very sympathetic office at the Navy Department.
Would that be ONR, or would that be that you're referring to, or?
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Well, I think that's about all I wanted to cover, unless there's some other things that I've missed in your career relative to radio astronomy, or any other comments that you'd like to make.
In dealing up through the 60s, I think that about covers it.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
That ends the interview with Robert Coates over the telephone from Northern Virginia to his home in Maryland on 15 August 1981. Sorry about how faint he comes through, but he just was a soft speaker, and that was the most I could get out of him. Believe me, the time lady came through much better than that when I tested the pickup before talking to him.